This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. All of his various discussions with and about outgoing Cincinnati Symphony music director Louis Langres have inspired Ken Smith to write an article called The Sound of the Orchestra. And that article appears in the March 2024 edition of the CSO Fanfare magazine. With Louis Langres' tenure as music director drawing to a close, audiences and musicians alike have pondered the past decade of life at the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. One of the most vivid changes, many agree, is still evident, even when Langres is nowhere near the podium. Apart from the world premieres and partnerships with other creative artists, a particularly notable component of Langres' legacy at the CSO has been the current sound of the orchestra itself. Former concertmaster Tim Lees, hired by former music director Paavo Järvi and continuing with Langres for more than half his tenure, literally heard those changes develop from the front lines. Paavo had a pretty vivid idea of what he wanted, but he was super demanding and ruled with an iron fist, says Lees. Louis came in and immediately talked about sound and color. CSO president and CEO Jonathan Martin puts it even more succinctly. Paavo had a very muscular approach, he says. Louis uses pastels. For Martin, the change in musical values has been expressed most vividly through dynamics. It's much more important for an orchestra to play softly than it is to play loudly. And Louis and the orchestra have spent an inordinate amount of time perfecting that, he says. You simply have more emotional impact with a whisper. Langres doesn't exactly disagree, but his ears have been focused on a bigger picture. Midway through putting his stamp on the CSO sound, the orchestra's home went through a drastic change. A 16-month, $143 million renovation that greatly reconfigured the stage and reduced audience capacity. The new music hall brought a new size, a new acoustic, a new range of color and dynamic possibilities, a whole new volume of sound, Langres says. Before, you had to actually project to give each attack an extra kick. Suddenly, we had a smaller stage with risers like an amphitheater to help carry the sound. One brass player told me that since he doesn't have to push so hard anymore, he can now focus on the subtleties. The new music hall required not just a new collective approach from the orchestra, but also a different type of musician coming in. From the beginning, Louis had this, not respect exactly, more of a reliance on individual musicians, says Lees. He'd never direct people to play a certain way. Paavo would come in and say, this is the way we're doing it. and he'd get great results. Louis would let the players take charge. But after the music hall renovation, Langres doubled down in looking for musicians with a collaborative mindset. Stefani Batsuo, who moved through the ranks from second violin section player to become the CSO's current concertmaster, replacing Lise when he left the position in 2019, notes the differences in her auditions. On a basic level, the required repertory is different for a title chair audition than it is for a section player, she says. But also, the playing quality that they were looking for was quite different. The second time around, there was a lot more room to show my interpretation, rather than just blending into a section. Part of that growing focus on individualism came from the sheer breadth of the orchestra's repertory. Langres may have come to the CSO with a reputation for core classics, being music director of Lincoln Center's now-defunct Mostly Mozart Festival, certainly helped in that regard, but he quickly revealed his inclinations to explore lesser-known works and champion living composers. Louis is quite open and fearless in the projects he's willing to tackle, says Matsuo. One week we're playing completely standard pieces, and the next it's all new music, with the composer standing in front of us, making changes to the piece in rehearsal. You need to be as well-rounded as possible, and always on your toes. Langres's continual search for distinct musical personalities. We don't want machines, he says. Might seem at odds with the CSO's policy of blind auditions, where musicians sit behind a curtain with no verbal interaction with the listening panel. But those challenges have simply made Langres's process more intense, his questions more pointed. Louis has always thought deeply about the people he was hiring, Lise adds. In orchestra auditions, the music director always turns up at the end, but sometimes much earlier. Louis would usually come midway and has been particularly focused on the flexibility of each player. He looks not just for great technicians, but for the people who would contribute the most to the fabric of the entire orchestra. And he's always very specific. He wants to see everything someone can do in 20 minutes.
If you want to make a list of Louis's accomplishments, right at the top is that he's hired more than a third of the musicians on this stage, Martin maintains. I've been thinking a lot in the past few years about what sets Louis apart. And I think it comes down to integrity. There's really no difference between what he brings to the podium and how he lives his life. There's the same core integrity, whether he's dealing with the repertory, or his relationships with the community, or his musicians on the stage. And he brings all of that core integrity directly into his hiring decisions. So really, if you want to talk about Louis's legacy, just take a look around the stage, Martin continues. That's another 50-year legacy.
In the April 2022 edition of the BBC Music magazine, Lay Abroad tells us about British composer Rebecca Clark. America's musical press in 1919 was awash with rumors about a new work, Rebecca Clark's Viola Sonata. It had just tied for first place in the prestigious Berkshire Festival Chamber Music Competition, for which all entries had to be submitted anonymously. The jurors had speculated that the sonata had been written by Ravel. When Clark was revealed as the composer, they were astonished. You should have seen their faces when they saw it was by a woman, the festival's patron confided to Clark. The sonata was hailed in the press as a work of greatest genius, compared favorably to pieces by Debussy. The sonata has remained one of Clark's best-known works and is now a staple of the viola repertoire. It also spearheaded the rediscovery of her music in the 1980s. Although famous in her day, by the time Clark died in 1979, very few people knew she had ever been a composer at all. She was sometimes mentioned in the same breath as her husband, the pianist James Friskin. The difference between her standing at the end of her life and the height of her career is staggering. Her entry in the 1980 Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians read, in its entirety, C. James Friskin. But in 1927, her entry in the same dictionary had been extensive, listing all her major works, including the sonata, her piano trio of 1921, and cello rhapsody of 1923, and a substantial quantity of songs. Like so many women composers, Clark's music was slowly excised from the historical record and is only now reclaiming a place in concert halls. Born in 1886 in Harrow, northwest of London, Clark had a difficult childhood. She was extremely close with her mother, Agnes, but had a strained and complex relationship with her father, Joseph. In the memoir Clark wrote in her 80s, she recalled that Joseph would beat all of his four children, sometimes really painfully. Needless to say, when Joseph instructed his daughter to take up an instrument, she did not take to it immediately. Like many middle-class fathers of his generation, Joseph wanted to nurture family music-making, being an amateur cellist himself. When they were old enough, his children were given violin lessons. Rebecca, being only a girl, was sent to her brother Hans' violin lessons rather than being taught individually. She hated playing the violin, and there were no indications that she would ever have any kind of musical career. Despite this inauspicious start, as a teenager, Clark developed a real appreciation for the music her father forced her to play. In music, she found an escape from her family life. At 16, with her mother accompanying her at the piano, she auditioned for the Royal Academy of Music, securing herself a place as a violin student. After just 2 years, however, her father removed her from the academy after her harmony teacher proposed to her. She later attended the Royal College of Music, where she was taught composition by Charles Stanford. All her life, she viewed her studies at the college as a happy time, an ecstatic time. And under Stanford's tutelage, she developed a distinctive compositional voice. When she was composing at her best, Clark felt flooded with a wonderful feeling of potential power, a miracle that made anything seem possible. While at the RCM, Clark transferred from violin to viola and became a famous performer and internationally recognized chamber musician on that instrument. In 1913, she became one of the first six women to be hired into a professional orchestra, the Queen's Hall Orchestra, under the direction of Sir Henry Wood. In the early 1920s, she toured through Asia, broadcast regularly on the fledgling BBC, and later formed an all-woman piano quartet called the English Ensemble, with whom she performed internationally. being a performer was vital to Clark's success as a composer. As she herself observed, some players showed a prejudice against women's compositions, making it difficult for many women to get their works performed. Clark, however, was able to play her own works with friends and colleagues, all performers of international standing, who made up her regular chamber ensembles. She gave the New York and London premieres of the Viola Sonata herself. Similarly, her cello rhapsody was premiered by her close friends pianist Dame Myra Hess and cellist May Mogul, who were also the instrumentalists for the premiere of Clark's piano trio with Marjorie Hayward on violin. Clark wrote her early works in the 1910s and 20s when London was a melting pot of musical influences, full of conflicting ideas about what modern music should sound like. Working alongside composers like Ravel, Clark played at his London concerts during the 1928 visit, and Vaughan Williams, who was a close friend and conducted for a Palestrina society that Clark co-founded. Clark's music was similarly occupied with all the latest musical ideas. Her trio, for example, opens with a fiery, violent blaze of dissonance that gives way to a menacing theme ground out on the cello. Tension never drops for a single second. Reviewers hailed her as a frank disciple of modernity, considering Clark one of the international modernist group that included not only figures like Ravel, but also names that have since fallen into comparative obscurity, like Ernest Bloch and Bernard van Dieren. Their music was as much part of Clark's musical world as Debussy and Stravinsky, alongside English composers such as Arnold Bax and Frank Bridge. Clark was also pioneering in her programming, often pairing contemporary music with 17th century works, in keeping with the modernist fascination with early music. Her contemporary, Peter Warlock, put together similar programs that juxtaposed and complemented old and new, as would Michael Tippett and Benjamin Britten after her. This interest in early music shines through in Clark's work, most noticeably in her Passacaglia on an Old English Tune, built on a melody by Thomas Tallis. Folk music was another source of inspiration, surfacing in her three Old English songs, 1924, and three Irish country songs in 1926, both for violin and voice. So too was the romantic repertoire that Clark grew up performing. Shades of Dvorak can be heard in her concert work Dumka for violin, viola, and piano, and Rachmaninoff in both the Passacaglia and I'll Bid My Heart Be Still from 1944, written for James Friskin and based on a Scottish folk tune. The single most enduring connection in Clark's music, though, is with the French school. It's no surprise, in some sense, that judges assumed her anonymous work to be by Ravel. They share a similar approach to harmony, form, and melody. And like Debussy before her, Clark was captivated by the sound of the Indonesian gamelan when she heard it played at the 1900 World Fair in Paris. Her work is steeped in the Orientalist sound so beloved by turn-of-the-century French modernists, saturating her viola works like Morpheus, 1916, Midsummer Moon, 1924, and, of course, the Sonata. Unusually, among composers of her generation, Clark traveled to the countries whose music inspired her. Indonesia was among the countries she visited on her 1922-1923 performance tour, and her 1919 song, Down by the Sally Gardens, was penned while in Hawaii, perhaps attempting to emulate the sound of the Chinese musicians she heard performing there. It's clear from all of Clark's music that she was a consummate performer. Her works have a theatricality that really relishes and showcases the physicality of music making. Nowhere is this more apparent than in her song, The Seal Man, 1922, telling the story of a young woman who drowns in the ocean trying to follow her lover. Both piano and vocal part are unashamedly dramatic, the singer alternating between sung and semi-spoken passages to differentiate between the individual characters in the song. And the piano part is virtuosic to the extent that it always threatens, like the sea, to overwhelm and overpower the vocalist. Singer and pianist have to be perfectly attuned to make this song work convincingly, creating an experience that can be truly electrifying in live performance. Clark is now established as one of the most important women composers of her generation. But as she sternly told a journalist, "I would sooner be regarded as a 16th-rate composer than be judged as if there were one kind of musical art for men and another for women." Gender prejudice during Clark's own lifetime pushed her out of the limelight. But her outstanding works should surely guarantee her a position as one of the most important musicians of her generation. A modernist composer, international performer, and pioneer of viola composition. In the CSO Fanfare magazine for March of 2024, Ken Smith asks outgoing music director Louis Langres about his audition process. "You've often talked about the ideal symphony repertory being a mixture of old and new, but now you say that about the players as well. Of course, tradition is very important. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra has their own DNA, a pride of ownership in their particular style. At the same time, like any institution, they need fresh blood, a rotation where a new generation learns from the veterans, while also bringing something unique to the table. The basis is still there, but the sound continually evolves. Is there an ideal balance, whether in age or experience or culture?" "It's not a theoretical thing. You can have older players who are still super enthusiastic, eager to discover new ideas, and you can also have young players who feel this is how they've played a piece and they don't want to change. So it's not objective, you see. It depends both on a particular orchestra's tradition and its recent history. A big change for the CSO was with Music Hall's recent renovation and the resulting new possibilities in sound." "So what do you look for in new players?" "I want to see a musician's personality. The individual level of playing has increased dramatically in the past decade, not just in Cincinnati, but all over the world. Maybe 40 years ago, it was enough to hire someone who could simply play the notes with proper clarity, articulation, and intonation. A true professional orchestra player. This generation is completely different. They are simply musicians. Depending on the circumstances, they also need to be soloists, chamber music players. What makes the difference is not technique, but charisma and quality of imagination. Some conductors say, 'I don't want to work with musicians who know as much as me.'
I'm just the opposite. I want to work with musicians who have an opinion. I have my opinion, too, but the musical process is to add, to confront, to create a musical dialogue. We should inspire each other. The true pleasure of orchestral musicians should be to play differently with every conductor without losing a sense of who they are. How do you discover in an audition situation if musicians are your kind of people? For example, I'll take a musical phrase, any phrase, and ask a candidate to play it as if it were from a Bach passion. Then I'd say, okay, now play it like a Puccini seduction aria. You can quickly gauge a player's musical culture. Do they have a sense of different musical styles, different articulations, different uses of vibrato? But you also get a sense of their musical imagination. The same raw phrase can take on such different meanings. Also, in the super final round, I have them play excerpts from the repertoire to see how quickly they can blend with other musicians. Recently, I had a tuba and bass trombone play a phrase in octaves, first with the tuba determining the phrasing and tone color, and then a second time with the trombone in the lead. Then a third time where they had to find a mix of the two. How many audition rounds are there? There's the preliminary round and semifinals. Then I come for the finals and superfinals. By then we know if musicians have a personality. We don't want machines. It used to be the very best orchestras in Europe had players with the best technique. Now, the difference is a higher level of energy, of courage and imagination. They don't wait for the conductor to tell them how to play. They want the conductor to inspire them to play differently than they did before. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.